have the ability to inform the public as to what's going on in a period of emergency based on the fact that cell phones and all these other things will fail, as they did in Superstorm Sandy, for instance. As such, will the Department of Homeland Security, from your point of view, also defend ham radio? Yes. We've got the ARRL and some other agencies that were defending us, but do we have one more ally? Yes, with reference to Department of Homeland Security. Am I asking for an opinion from your point of view? Because when it comes to public safety, you're involved in it. KE2EJ, KE2LAW.
KE2RAW, KE2J. And some of the, what do they call, the Notice of Modification of Frequency, the Department of Homeland Security has very much backed up amateur radio in their proceedings. So, yeah, we've got a friend there.
So Joe, the guy who asked the original question, I think there's more good news than bad news. Yes, we've got to keep a watchful eye. Yes, we've got to defend it. Yes, we've got to make sure that the ARRL knows the everything that's going on so that they can defend us. But with our track record, with our history of making extremely good use of those frequencies, both for public safety and public service and technical development, like cell phones, among other things, I don't think we've got a great deal to worry about, Joe. That's my belief. But maybe I've got some rosy-colored glasses. I know we got pretty far left of your original question, but it was a damn good one. KC2QIW, glad you asked it. K2IW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Joe.
By the way, we also have a friend in the NTIA, so let's use this another one.
Fantastic. I'm going to come back to you for a few words on that after Joe speaks. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, Roger, Roger. Name here is Joe from Harrison, New York, Westchester County. Yeah, that was one of my questions, and I was kind of worried about it because, you know, I have a lot of HF and 2 meter in the car and 2 meter up in the home base, and I don't want all this good equipment go to waste because the freaking government decides to take like half of our frequencies away. And then next week I have another question, a really, really good question, but I'll wait until next week. Yeah, thank you very much, and be safe out there. Back to the net.
Well done, Joe. And looking forward to your question next week. Eric, you wanted to give us a few more words on that last statement of your Eric. KE2EJ, KE2LAW.
Yeah, the National Telecommunications Association also puts in a good word for amateur radio. In a lot of the proceedings, Congress has asked Department of Homeland Security, the NTIA, and a lot of the commercial users, which aren't very friendly to us because they want more bandwidth. And again, their bandwidth that they're interested in is really VHF, UHF, and microwave. So they're actually opening up a new section of 2 gigs for the phone companies. Just the weird thing about it is AT&T and Sprint and this one, that one have, but they bought spectrum that they're still not using. So, I mean, the whole thing's crazy.
Wasn't there a period of time fairly recently in which the second big auction, the first big auction under Clinton seemed to be very successful, created a lot of cash flow for our government, so to speak, and a lot of people bought spectrum and some of them got use out of it. And I think there was a second auction downrange where everyone was hoping it was going to be equally as successful as the first one, and I think it was not. That's my foggy memory on that one, Eric, and why don't you clear it up a little bit. What was that second and third auction like if there were such frequency auctions? KE2EJ, KE2LAW?
Serves you well, but when the actually Congress less so the Senate, when they hear the word auction, they say, "Oh, we're going to get billions of dollars to the spectrum state. Let's sell it." Yet they seem to have very short memories. The auction to get rid of the broadcasters comes in 2014 and be gearing up for it. This one's voluntary, so it's going to be interesting to see how this one plays out.
second auction, though, that there was great big hopes for it, and almost nobody showed up to the auction, so to speak. A lot of the cash flow that was supposed to happen didn't take place. Am I remembering that incorrectly, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, you're remembering it right. Not nobody showed up. The interest was, of the big guys, was small because they had just spent a whole lot of money on a whole lot of stuff that they're still not using. So, but, you know, Congress changes. The people in Congress change. Politics changes. Also, interestingly enough, the upcoming auction doesn't take low-power transmitters into consideration, low-power TV stations. These organizations and their lobbying organizations are really up in arms. And then, of course, there's the CEA, which represents the television manufacturers. And they think only 9% of the country is on TV sets and it. And then there's the NTIA that says it's something like 30. And then there's the NAP that says it's something like almost 40. So there's a lot of lobbying going on.
It sounds like each is using their own narrow set of glasses to look at it from their point of view. That's a lot of differences. 90%, 30%, 40%. Is there any truth in any of those numbers, Eric? Are any of them even close to the real ballpark? Over to you, Eric.
No, I said 9%, not 90%. Yeah, the constant dispute. Nielsen and Arbitron actually are good suppliers of the numbers, and their numbers run in the 35% range because, you know, we live in a metropolitan area, which is all very well wired. Once you start getting into places like Iowa and Nebraska and even in Texas, stringing cables to the people that live 30 miles down the road from the trunk ain't worth it to them. So, it's a different country. It's all geography is way different. And where people are different. When you get a metropolitan area, it's one thing. And that's where it seems to be a spectrum crunch. Because not only do you have a lot of people in a small area, but you have a lot of services. You have a lot of public service stuff. You have a lot of commercial stuff going on. It's crowded.
You could comment. I hear you. Good information. Somebody just said comment. I'm going to go back to you in a minute. But, Eric, you've readjusted the gain of this repeater tonight, and you've hit it on the money, I believe, or extremely close to being on target. Where we started off with everybody's audio sounding distorted, almost everybody sounds good. Take that gain setting you've got right now, Eric, and write it on the wall. Make sure you can be able to go back to that one. You sound good, and I mean it. I wasn't just inflating your ego, if you know what I mean. K2EJ, K2LIW.
Yeah, well, why does this level I changed the compression threshold off on? The problem is that where the changes were made is in the analog section of the controller, so it's just going to have to stay where it is. I mean, I have numbers for where the digital part of the repeater is set, so I guess I'm just going to have to leave the knobs where they are, so to speak.
I wish tonight you would epoxy those knobs where they are, if you know what I mean. I know these are digital settings in a computer, but write them down in your great big notebook. Make sure you can be able to go back to those. The person who wants to make another comment, please give us your call letters and name first. K2LIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
K2RW, this is WJ2B in Smithtown. I just had a quick comment about the digital. I was listening to the conversation about the transition to digital TV, and I just wanted to make a quick comment that I would think a major part of the problem was the transition from the VHF frequencies, from 50 to 174 up to the UHF band, and obviously the propagation of the signal was much better on VHF, being that it didn't have to be so line of sight now as the way they have on the UHF band. So I thought maybe that has a lot to do with it, other than just the changing of the format from analog to digital. But maybe UHF is causing, you know, people that were, like, you know, needing line of sight that didn't have it before, and that's why they can't get a good signal, if I'm correct in assuming that. Back over you to WJ2B.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Joe. Channel 2, 4, 5, and 6, the lower VHF frequencies, propagate extremely well. Your upper VHF frequencies, 7 through 13, almost as well. When you go to UHF, although the antenna is smaller, that's the good news. The effective capture of the antenna is also smaller. That's the bad news. Foliage attenuation. When you're looking through a forest of trees, particularly when they're fully foliated and when there's water on those wet leaves right after a rain, the UHF signal goes through there and gets sucked up, turned into heat, absorbed, and it's gone. So unless on UHF you can have an antenna that's a little bit higher to clear those trees, you're not going to get good UHF reception. So that's a big factor. However, digital television was absolutely positively forced into the upper VHF, UHF frequencies. You study what, let me drop. In the case of channel 2, for instance, if you had a pulpit transformer or an insulator of LIPA or Con Ed breaking down in front of your house, it's going to make these snow bars, two of them, that slowly drift across the screen, and the impulse static that you get from the lower VHF frequencies shows up on the screen. It's annoying, but you still got reception. That kind of impulse static is absolutely intolerable, to my knowledge, on a digital television demodulator. As such, I suspect the total number of lower VHF digital television signals, channels, transmitters, broadcast centers in the United States, I bet you can almost count them on one or two hands. I'm going to go over to Eric for a confirmation on that. Because of that disadvantage of impulse noise tears up that signal something terrible when it comes to digital television, and because impulse noise falls off 6 dB per octave, by the time you get up to UHF, it's very tolerable. Impulse noise from the static of a lawnmower, of a noisy ignition system of an automobile, or breakdown of high-voltage insulators on a power distribution system. So am I correct in guessing that that's the main reason why channels 2 through 6 almost don't exist in digital television? KE2EJ, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, you can count the number of channel 2s on one hand. The number of channel 3s and 4s you can count on one and a half hands. If you want to count from channel 6 and up, actually 7 and up, there's quite a few. And channel 13's on channel 13, channel 11's on 11, 7's on 7, whereas 2 is in UHF, 5 is in UHF, but 9 is in UHF, and then the rest of them are UHF, so. Yeah, terrestrial noise is a real problem. So, although it's gotten a lot better with the newer technology, it's a little more tolerance of it. Not that much, but more tolerance.
To make a more and more elaborate equalizer to settle to digitally, electronically, time domain, Z transform, cancel, multipath. I see that possibility. But impulse noise, by the way, what's going on with multipath is it has extremely high predictability. It's deterministic. In other words, whatever multipath you're getting in this hour is going to be extremely similar in multipath characteristics in the next hour. And even if it took you 10 minutes for your equalizer to figure it all out and come to a solution, as long as that solution will hold for the rest of the night, that's a tolerable situation. But the pure randomness in the time domain, amplitude domain, phase domain of impulse noise, I am guessing that there is nothing coming down the pike that is going to be able to take a digital television signal system and make it adaptable and tolerable to impulse noise. That's my guess. Am I even close to correct on this one, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
5 years ago, that's an absolutely perfect statement, but you're leaving something out. In the method of ATSB transmission, we have a thing called Pfeller, and a pseudo-random number generator. So the actual part of what's being sent by each symbol, only a very small part of it, to put it in simple terms, is actually real data. The rest of it is a pseudo-random number which has a seed, and if you make your receiver smart enough to know about that seed, you stand a chance of dealing with the impulse noise that's not repetitive, you know, that's just completely random. And if you do it over time, and you do it, if you actually, it's sort of like, how do I say this, sort of like the dropout compensator in a TV set, in a tape recorder. If you keep the numbers from the last transmission, the last round of symbols, and you repeat them when you can't decode them, you stand a chance of keeping it going, so to speak. How's that?
Okay. That dropout circuit that we had in our digital, in our video cassette recorder, I see it has some applicability in this case. Still, I'm worried about the fact that is there enough forward error correcting? In the case of packet data transmission, where each packet is sent, and in many cases is something similar to a cyclic redundancy code, in other words, a bit testing, a testing procedure is within it to know whether or not the integrity of the data in that packet is good enough, and if not, the packet is resent, or if there's enough Viterbi encoding, then there's enough excess information that you can reconstruct the garbled bits in certain kinds of packet information, certain kinds of digital information. I'm not so convinced with your extremely high data rate for video that you can pack enough forward error correcting extra bits into it so that the corrupted data can be reconstructed after these impulses coming along. The impulse in many cases 10, 20, 30, 40 dB stronger than the desired signal. No way in hell. I mean, it's going to definitely obliterate some of those bits. And if there is not enough forward error correcting capability in the protocol, then I don't think reconstruction of the missing data is very likely. Maybe I'm pessimistic. Over to you on this one, Eric. Get you out.
WHYY.
Joe recognized, but Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, you still have very analog thinking. First of all, stop thinking about video, because the video itself is DCT, it's just not like bit for bit. And you have to think of before the encoder, before the data decoder, and what you do with the data after you've decoded it, okay, because the read Solomon, the Viterbi, what they call the auto mode correction, that happens after you've converted it from RF to bits. The trellis occurs before the decoder, so there's two separate things that you got to look at. There is nowadays in the front ends of the newer receivers something that watches the trellis and watches the pseudo number of it. The pseudo random number that's being generated. How do I explain this? You're absolutely correct in terms of the impulse noise being loud and causing everything to crash. As long as you keep that decoder clocking, right, and you're able to break it down into I and Q, and you keep a record of the stream of I and Q that's come previously, when you get that kind of disturbance, you can fill it up with the previous round of I and Q, if that makes any sense to you. But you're absolutely right in terms of the impulse noise being a really big problem. K2RIW, K2J.
But Joe recognized, but Eric just hit on something. Eric, keep it clocking. If the broadcast center is locked to the National Bureau of Standards by way of a, you know, the system that gives you positioning, automatic positioning systems. You know what I'm trying to think of. My mind's going blank on it. Anyway.
GPS.
GPS, sorry. GPS can give you exact timing of the transmission at the broadcast center. If my coder, if my digital demodulator in the television set in my home had access to the exact same timing accuracy of GPS, could that help the clock keep going even when the data gets obliterated? I get the impression that when crashing occurs, you've lost the clock. By external means, can we keep the clock going? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Now, the way things are today, if you're a Class A station or greater, you have at your transmitter site a GPS trained operator. Right? You require some. In essence, you're generating your ATSB and you're doing the final clocking of your ASI streams into the transmitter via that GPS-trained oscillator. So, yeah, if your receiver had a similar thing, you can guarantee a synchronous clock. But you got to remember that everything really runs asynchronously the way things are today. And if you're not a Class A or greater station, like some low powers and translators and stuff like that, they use our own internal oscillator, and those things run at whatever speed they run at.
Okay. A high percentage of the population now owns GPS receivers. We don't consider them super expensive. If I had to add a GPS function to my television over-the-air broadcast demodulator, and if that exact timing of its clock could become synchronous with the timing of the clock at the broadcast transmitter, would that help me keep the demodulator running in the presence of impulse noise? Over to you, Eric, K2LAW.
Yes, you could. Of course, you would have to, you know, there would be a period of time when you first turn to the station where you could find the sync bits that are being sent. Because you now have a reference that's running a constant rate, you know, you would actually phase the clock a certain number of periods to get the sync bits in the right place, and then once you do that, you're off and running. Yeah, that would be a way to do it. Although, you're being able to go out now and buy a TV set that costs, you know, $250, may all of a sudden go up to $300 or $350, but, you know, that's economic.
Hold on now. I think we're onto something here, Joe. I mean, Eric. The Joe Taylor technique, WSJT, weak signal Joe Taylor, K1JT, by Reed Solomon-like procedures, by exact timing and whatever, he is able to allow very weak signals. 28 decibels below the noise can give you an acceptable amount of bit error rate writing that message across the screen. As such, some very minuscule by comparison moonbound systems are suddenly doing moonbounds with very mediocre equipment compared to what used to be required. That's item number one. Let me drop. Item number two. I worked on a synchronous demodulator system development program a couple of years ago, which allowed me to take a very noisy signal and suck that signal out of the noise because I had a priori knowledge as to the frequency and phase of the desired signal, and I set up this synchronous demodulator that probably knocked down the noise at least 30 decibels because of synchronous demodulation. So now, if I'm willing to add, so here's my proposal, here's my speculation. If I'm willing to add a global positioning satellite system disciplined oscillator to my television receiver. And by the way, there is such a disciplined oscillator inside of your GPS receiver. That's how it works. And GPS receivers are getting relatively inexpensive. So that disciplined oscillator, traceable to the bureau, is there already. And if I can tap into it and add it to the clock of the digital television demodulator system, which is now synchronized to the clock that's at the broadcast center, I think there's a hell of a lot of times when my demodulator writes weak signal across the screen and gives me a blank screen and locks up and it loses everything. I think a lot of those could be avoided. Am I being naive here, Eric? And why aren't people pursuing this if it has this merit? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Why they're not pursuing it, I couldn't tell you. Not that the idea wasn't there, because that's how things started originally, before they developed the system that they wound up with. What we're doing now in terms of, like, weak signal from home zones, I mean, understand what you're talking about here. We're talking about a whole lot of stuff, which doesn't really matter. But yet, if it was a synchronous decoder, you could literally interrupt the stream. Now, there's two things that you got to think about here, too. One, again, is your transmission, and then the actual stream that you're getting out. It's a fucking number, 19.3934, I forget what it is, it's like a six decimal place number. And in reality, when you're doing something called statistical multiplexing, you sometimes go under and you sometimes go over, which is sort of irrelevant when you're looking at it from the RF point of view. So from the transmission point of view, that synchronous decoder is perfect. Why they're not doing it? Well, you need a GPS antenna, you need to be able to see the sky, yeah? So, that could be a combination antenna. As far as why the manufacturers are not interested in doing that, your guess is as good as mine. K2RIW, K2J.
You and I have recently transmitted information back and forth about global positioning satellite receiver system disciplining a reference oscillator. And many of the microwave guys have been discussing that for the last 2 years with quite great integrity. I found out I didn't save enough of those, and I was able to send enough of them to you to see the whole picture. But at least among the fairly serious microwave group of amateur radio operators, disciplining an oscillator to get 1 hertz of accuracy at 10 gigs, there are guys doing it. It's not rocket science. They're not just spending $1 zillion doing it. And so to find ways of inexpensively doing it with a television receiver, because you went over the broadcast reception in what you think is a high multipath area, I see a lot of application there. I'm not sure I can talk my ham radio friends into this one. The adaptable antenna, yes. The disciplined synchronous demodulator digital television receiver, that's going to be a tough one. Joe, I know you want to say something on all of the above. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-Y-W in the TechNet.
Let me say this. If I could find, GPS disciplined oscillators, I'd have multiple transmitters on this repeater frequency.
Run that by again, a little bit more slowly. If you had that GPS disciplined oscillator, you'd have multiple signals on this exact frequency. Is that sort of what you were saying, Eric? Go a little more slowly on that. Give us some words.
Yeah, one of the things that I want to do with W2VL is have several transmitters all on the same frequency. If I can guarantee that I can lock them all together and keep them in phase, I'll do it in a heartbeat.
There's good and bad about that, Eric. Multiple transmitters all locked to the exact same frequency and phase means that they don't beat against each other and give you a growl. Yes, that's going to eliminate the growl. However, when you have multiple signals coming from multiple directions on the exact same frequency, you have built a phased array. By definition, although there are miles apart of the individual elements of the phased array, you're still going to be generating a whole bunch of fingers in space of antenna pattern. Therefore, as a guide draws a circle around your W2VL, he's going to find a very cyclic kind of peak and valley of signal amplitude as he draws that circle. So it's a definite improvement, but it's not a cure-all. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
J2B with a comment.
Totally aware of that. And believe you me, once you get on the other side of Jane Hill, it would be dynamite.
Okay. Joe wanted to make a comment. And Joe number one was W-A-2-R-Y-Y, and then Joe number two, W-J-2-B in that order. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W. Go ahead, Joe number one.
Okay, very good. You're talking about television reception in these Dakotas, receiving stuff at low frequencies, picking up noise impulses and things like that. I agree. The reception is terrible down there. I have very hard difficulty, high difficulty getting channels from that are in that band, unless the bands open up quite a bit. What I'm trying to understand is, does the noise impulse being present in the receiver cause the receiver to see the wrong bit? And if it simply didn't see the noise impulse for that same amount of time, would that cause the same effect? Can you answer that in simplicity very quickly? Because before you say, I have something else to add to this.
It's all about the symbol, Dick.
Okay. Let me backtrack a little bit here for people who are listening. Arguably the best guy in the New York City area doing digital television DXing for the last year or so is W2RYY. He has set up a rotatable antenna, some pretty good preamplifiers, the right kinds of demodulators, and he's gotten digital television on occasion from very long distances. So he's a digital television DXer. And when it comes to the goods and the bads of the various kinds of digital television demodulators, Joe is tuned to that situation, so to speak. When it comes to what does an impulse noise do to a digital signal, I think Eric's going to have to explain that to us because I've been doing quite a bit of guessing here. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Guy, to put it very simply, okay, you have a chain of pulses that are coming to your receiver. The impulse noise might actually look like several of these pulses all put together in terms of time. And every 188 package worth of bits, there is a special symbol which is used as a synchronization pulse. And that creates the clocks within the receiver. If the receiver is asynchronous, it's always looking for that little bit of pulses. You put a wide pulse in there, it no longer detects where that particular period of time is, and it starts hunting the oscillators inside, starts looking for another one of those special pulses, and it takes a few moments for it to find it. And that few moments to find it, you get no picture, you get no sound.
So if that finding circuit didn't have to find it, if it had a priori knowledge by way of a disciplined oscillator from a GPS receiver, could it keep rolling right through the bad periods? And even if it were to, you would get some snow on the screen, some squitter on the screen, but if the system knows that the signal-to-noise ratio degraded during that period of time, and it uses the dropout eliminator, similar to which used in a video cassette recorder, I think we could possibly get the best of both worlds here. We can keep that oscillator in the digital demodulator rolling correctly, synchronously, if we give it this extra piece of information. I think it's time we do. Maybe I'm simplistically naive here. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Simplistically, that's definitely the answer. I mean, you have to establish a lock first and get it in the right phase, and once you've done that, you just keep it running. You know, you could probably keep it running forever, and it would always be in the right spot. But, you know, you change channel, it's going to have to lock, search up for it, and lock up again.
I'm willing to do that. I'm willing to have the system at night while I'm not using it. It goes to each one of the channels. It finds out what is the phase difference of the reference oscillator for each one of those channels. Therefore, when I wake up in the morning and really turn the set on, it already has that information in storage. It knows what the phase shift to use for the oscillator for channel 13. Is that possible, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
All things being equal, but the station doesn't turn their transmitter off and, you know, reestablish its position in life, yeah.
Although I know there's going to be some reluctance on this, is it possible to tell the broadcast center, the broadcast transmitting signal, that each time you come on, please lock up the same way? Keep reference as to where you were when you went off the last time, so when you come back on, you're locked up the same way. Is that doable, Eric? K2EJ, K2LIW?
That actually happens now, as long as you don't turn your GPS disciplined oscillator. If your oscillator keeps going, no, that's not right, because there's nothing in it that says start here. All it says is that as your reference, make your oscillator go at this speed. It doesn't say start the oscillator right here, or start the chain of data, or start the symbol at this particular point in time. There's nothing in there that does that. Not to say that it can't be added, but it doesn't exist at this point.
Dick? I'm positive that can be added. There are very specific reference points. The seconds ticks that are coming out of the National Bureau out of WWV and so on. So it isn't going to take a whole lot of expensive circuitry to make sure that your bitstream.
It would take the edge to 1 PPS.
Okay. It is or isn't possible in your mind to make sure that each time you start off with your new stream of information, that starts off with the right synchronization that would have been there had you never changed programs and never turned the system off. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, I suspect you could probably use the edge of the 1 PPS coming out of the GPS. Although I'd have to do the math to figure out how many ticks it would take before you come back into the same spot, but yeah.
Is there enough advantage to doing this? Yes, it's going to take extra effort at the transmitting site, and it's going to take extra circuitry at the receiver site. But if all of a sudden we become, let me pick a number, 10 times more immune to multipass, boy, I think this is worth it. KE2EJ, K2LIW?
That's too expensive.
It wouldn't be too expensive. You know what? This is a conversation I should have with Mr. Signoli. I think he'd be interested in thinking about that.
Mr. Smagnoli is the guy who wrote a set of very pivotal technical reports describing the Trellis system, the 8 VSB system. He literally sold the United States on the system that we're now using. And here's a enhancement to the system that gets around one of its major disadvantages. Is that approximately what's going on here, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
One of the original researchers and inventors.
Okay, so he is the beginning of the Nile here. And if we can convince him, I mean, I have learned the faith of synchronous demodulation. My goodness, can it do things that you couldn't even dream about. You can take a system where when you've got a noisy signal and yes, if you're willing to integrate the living daylights out of the signal, you can get the signal out of the noise. You're making the equivalent noise bandwidth extremely narrow. That's the good news. But all of a sudden, your temporal response time goes down the tubes. You've got to wait around forever for the signal to be recognized. With synchronous demodulation, I've watched something that would have taken a second to display the data to do it in real time in microseconds instead. And so it's time that this get applied. Joe, I know you want to make a comment, and there's another did Joe number one, I think Joe number one made his appointment, made his comment. Joe number two, WJ2B, K2LAW. Go ahead, Joe number two.
Hey, guys. Hello, everybody on the net, WJ2B. Yeah, it sounds like it's a possibility. I mean, I know there are synchronous. I actually have a little unit from Trimble that goes into cell phone sites. There's a guy out in China selling refurbished little units for about $200 that you put in a GPS antenna into it. I have one outside of my house, and it Fox the GPS signals, the one part per, you know, the one pulse per second, and it uses that to discipline an ovenized 10 megahertz oscillator that's inside the unit. So if you leave that thing running for about 24 to 48 hours, it's accurate to about 10 to the minus 13th parts per million or something like that, parts per billion or something around that area. I have the specs on it. I don't remember the model number, but I know I picked it up from a guy out in China, sent it to me. He was getting these and refurbishing them, and they have a very, very high accuracy once they've been running for about 48 hours. So that kind of technology does exist. It's fairly inexpensive. You know, whether or not you can integrate that into a TV, now you need a GPS receiver, GPS antenna along with each TV. So that the already designed commercial technology for digital TV might be a little bit far down the line now to start adding GPS capability to discipline the oscillator in there and all that, and probably add quite a bit of cost to the TV. So anyway, I also have another interesting subject. Maybe we'll save it for the next TechNet. But so I ran across an internet news report about a new technology to wirelessly charge cell phones, which is extremely interesting. It involves phased array antennas, Wi-Fi frequencies, and it's extremely interesting. I have information about it if you guys want to talk about it later or next time. WJ2B.
Yeah, your second subject, Joe, I think falls into the area of what's called energy harvesting and wireless charging. There's a fair amount of research going on there. I was involved in a little bit of the searches for those kinds of techniques a year or so ago, and there's some good news and some bad news on that one, and so more of that is going to take place, energy harvesting, and it's one of the many subjects we could be discussing later. We're way beyond the point where I should have gone over to the mailbag and to the space net, but after that we got to get into the more serious subjects, and the one that you just mentioned is a certain possibility. I know that Wes has one he wants to discuss, and I know that we got all kinds of good subjects. There's, as I've been saying for some time, there's a real thirst for knowledge because the schools are doing a mediocre job of teaching wireless techniques, and that's what we're getting into here, real application, real wireless techniques, the hardware behind the front panel that makes it happen and makes it happen better. I better break off now and go over to way beyond the point where it should have gone to the mailbag, and some of those people have to go to sleep to go to school the next day. John, KC2WGB, tell us a little bit about some of the letters you got this week. Some of the last ones are real mind blowers. KC2WGB, KQLIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, good evening, Dick, Paul, everyone on the net. Well, Dick, it's kind of late. Most of my guys are sleeping, but I do have one contributor who's pretty much a regular, who's probably up. I think I can cover his question. Let me let it drop. Okay. Roy had a question on Mel's antenna that he had in the tree, and he wanted to know, how did he get the propagation pattern with the antenna without extended ground radials in his yard? Maybe you could explain exactly or a little better how it worked. I know we've covered this antenna many times, but Roy had a few questions on it. Why isn't it performing like a NVIS, and why didn't he need the ground radials? How actually did he get a counterpoise for it? And then just run through the basic elements of it. That was his question. And I know he's up to hear this one. So back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, I can tell this is a goodie. I just spent the last few days involved in an entirely different technology. In other words, a high-performance, radio-controlled, electrically powered model aircraft. And right now, my mind's a partial blank on the previous conversation. I can tell we're recalling a previous conversation of somebody. You're going to have to give me some words on this one, John. Bring me up to speed as to what we did in the past about the antenna in the tree with or without counterpoise. Was it a thoroughly balanced antenna, like a pure vertical dipole? mounted in a tree. You can really do beautiful things with no apparent counterpoise. Is that close to what we discussed in the past? KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Dick, this was a conversation about a month and a half ago about Mel's antenna that he had rigged in a tree right in his front yard, and it worked beautiful, and he had a great radiating pattern, and they just want to understand what he did. I believe that was a half wave, and his counterpoise was just a ground rod at the bottom of the tree. There were no extended radials, if I remember correctly.
Well done, John. You said the magic words. Antenna in the tree, in the front yard, and Mel, meaning Mel Schneider, case, here we go, K2KEY. Now I remember the episode. Everyone thinks, particularly on HF frequencies, that a quarter wave ground plane, the radiator must be a quarter wave. And let me backtrack to get you into the picture. Assume I've got a real half-wave dipole in free space, fed with twin lead transmission line. So I got a balanced transmission line. Assume I had a balanced transmitter, and I've got a really balanced dipole antenna. At one instant of time, the right side of the dipole is more positive, the left side is more negative. In the next half cycle, it's the other way around. I can put a sheet of metal down the middle of that dipole, normal to the dipole. And because there is a neutral plane there, because the right side is positive, the left side is negative, there is a neutral plane where my sheet of metal is, which really is 0 volts. Putting the sheet of metal there makes no change to the pattern, the gain, the impedance, the standing wave. Nothing changes. Once that sheet of metal is there, you can decide to feed the right side of the dipole with reference to the sheet of metal. And when you do that, we call it a quarter wave ground plane. That's the good news. That's the origin, so to speak, in people's thinking. Let me drop. But for that system to be perfect, the sheet of metal should go to infinity. None of us can do that. So you put a real quarter wave ground plane vertical antenna in your backyard, and you lay down a whole bunch of ground plane radials. And you start off with them all a quarter wavelength long, and if this is the best of all worlds, you're going to lay down 32 or 64 of them. Let me drop. That's a lot of resources. Okay, let's go back to the original half-wave dipole. That half-wave dipole was an ideal antenna all by itself, requiring no counterpoise. You could simplistically say that if the right-hand side is positive and the left-hand side is negative, the left-hand side is acting like the counterpoise during that half-cycle. And on the next half-cycle, the other way around. The best way to get a counterpoise is a quarter wavelength of collinear antenna to a quarter wave. I've got a quarter wave radiator, the right-hand side. The left-hand side is another quarter wave collinear antenna, and it is the world's most perfect counterpoise. No sheet of metal is required. As you can see, there's a huge amount of magic of making the radiator half wave instead of quarter wave. And when you recognize the fact that to transmit a signal out of any reasonable size antenna, it is a standing wave structure. Those words are said in a lot of books, and nobody explains to them what it means. Standing wave structure means that that energy you launch into that antenna is going to bounce back and forth something like 10 or 20 times before it finally gets radiated. And what you and I call resonance is adjusting the electrical lens such that all of those 10 or 20 bounces all stay in step with each other, stay co-phased. That's what the definition, one of the many definitions of reference, of resonance is. Okay. Once you recognize it is a resonating structure, it's an energy storage structure, a flywheel isn't too different from that. I can decide to feed energy into a flywheel by using a push rod that's near the pivot point or near the perimeter. That's my choice. Near the perimeter, I'm going to feed, let me drop. I put my push rod, like the thing that's on the steam engine on a railroad train, that push rod that's turning the wheel, it's the flywheel, so to speak. I can put the push rod out of the perimeter, I'm feeding a high impedance flywheel. Or I can put the push rod very close to the pivot center, and I'm feeding a very low impedance flywheel. In either case, I'm dumping energy into that flywheel.
Well, when you're feeding energy into your dipole, it really is a kind of a flywheel, the electronic equivalent. As such, you can decide to feed it in the center. You can decide to feed it halfway between center and the outer edge. You can decide to feed it at the outer edge. If you're smart enough to feed it at the outer edge, and if you're smart enough to realize that it's a little bit more difficult to feed the 1,500 ohm impedance you get at the outer edge instead of the 72 ohm impedance you get in the center, and that's a very simple LC network, one inductor, one capacitor, will step up the impedance, do the right resonating, and now you're feeding the outer edge of the dipole. So that halfway dipole fed at the outer edge needs no counterpoise, because instead of feeding, in the case of the quarter wave ground plane, which is half of the dipole fed in the center is 72 ohms, half of the dipole is 35 ohms. When you put a quarter wave resonator, quarter wave radiator, above a counterpoise, you're feeding approximately a 35 ohm impedance. As such, you want the counterpoise, your ground plane radials, to be very low in resistive component compared to 35 ohms. You'd like them to be 0.35 ohms, 100 times lower. It takes a whole lot of ground plane radials to do that. If I was using another half of the quarter wave radiator in the other direction, making it a half wave, it does that all automatically for you. And by the way, it does some more radiating. So there's a whole lot of advantages of feeding the outer impedance, the 1,500 ohms. Now that ground plane, that ground rod you stick in the ground, let me drop. For that system to be efficient, all you need is for that grounding rod to be small in impedance compared to 1,500 ohms compared to 35 ohms. If you know what I mean. A quarter wave ground plane antenna, quarter wave radiator, you want the ground plane radio, the counterpoise, to be very small compared to 35 ohms. You'd like it to be 0.35 ohms if you can get it. In the case of feeding the outer half wave, outer edge of a half wave dipole, you want the ground plane, you want your counterpoise, the rest of the earth that you're using as a grounding system, to be small compared to 1,500 ohms. All right? 100 times lower than 1,500 ohms is 15 ohms. To get a grounding rod have an impedance of 15 ohms is easy. To get it to equal 0.35 ohms is very hard. That's one way of looking at it. So Mel recognized all of this. First of all, the halfway piece of wire, it requires a taller tree. It's got a much lower angle of radiation. It's got a much higher phase center of radiation. And feeding the outer edge is extremely easy, and a simple ground rod would use the whole dark earth in his front yard as the counterpoise. And you're starting to get the picture as to how very simple techniques, let me drop, very simple techniques can give you very high performance. The reason it's not being done is tradition. We all learn a dipole antenna by looking at a schematic in the book that gave you instruction on it, and they showed it as a thoroughly parallel piece of wire to the ground, completely out flat, with no bends in it anywhere, not even an inverted V, and a transmission line going to the center with a mounting device. That's the way we first get introduced to a dipole, and we're afraid to think that any other method is going to work, that if you change that a whole lot, it's going to fail. Well, if you stop doing that fixed thinking, and if you're willing to open your brain, open your mind, so to speak, and recognize that a half-wave radiator is a hell of a lot better than a quarter-wave radiator, and fed from the bottom just has a slight increase in difficulty in which you're feeding 1,500 ohms instead of 35 ohms. And by the way, many of us are using a 5/8 wave ground plane antenna, mag mount, on 2 meters on our automobile, or on 450 on our automobile. And that's an extremely high impedance antenna with an impedance matching device built into that magnet. And it's not that elaborate. It's a very simple coil that's tapped, if you know what I mean. So, once you go to that website, let me drop. Once you go to that Berkeley website, if you Google the word Berkeley and impedance match, that's done by Berkeley College, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y. You Google the word combination of impedance matching and Berkeley, and you tell it that your particular antenna is a 1,500 ohm impedance at your particular frequency, 7.15 megacycles, for instance. And you give it that raw information, and you press go, and it will give you 15 solutions. and you can choose whichever solution you want. And the first four solutions are a very simple one inductor, one capacitor, LC network. An L network will do that impedance, step up, resonating, do everything all for you automatically. So choosing the right inductor, choosing the right capacitor, value is easy. Choosing one that's big enough that's going to run in your kilowatt, you've got to be a little bit more careful, but you know exactly what's going to happen ahead of time by the raw information you're given, so to speak. So don't throw away half-wave vertical antennas. They're not nevus. They have very low angle of radiation, very high gain, very high impedance, very easy to feed, don't require any ground plane radials. Other than that, they're great. Why aren't we doing it? Simply because of tradition. Because not enough people have been told how good it is and how to do it. Step by step, you and I, John, are going to educate people how to do it. Mel tried doing it. Various people told him he was crazy when he first proposed to do this. When they heard his signal on the air, they said, "What in the world are you using? Tell me about that. And how is it working so well?" It had one hell of a track record. KC2WGB, KQRIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Evidently, Roy didn't hear that explanation when it was discussed, I think it was a couple of months ago, month and a half ago. But I'm sure he's got the explanation now, and that was something I thought needed attention tonight. By the way, are you hearing the echo from the 375 machine tonight?
Okay, I'm going to go listen. Oh, yes, I'm hearing myself. With delay. I can tell, therefore, we're back to using some kind of an internet-like connection. The RF link apparently is not operational. Let's see if Eric is available to explain this one. KE2EJ, KQLAW.
Dick, the RF link is at the 900s working. I'm monitoring. You're coming in crystal clear. But I told this with Lou and Eric on the phone the other night, on the radio the other night, and they did not hear the delay. I thought it was just something wrong with my installation here. Glad you heard it. KC2WGB.
Now, right now, listening to my voice coming back on 85, absolutely no delay. I'm listening to my voice coming back on 375, and I'm hearing a couple of seconds of delay. So I think the system has got some kind of an automatic mode where it decided to jump into using the internet connection, which has got the latency, as opposed to the RF link right now. So if you heard the delay, I'm hearing the delay, and if I tried to listen to it continuously, I'd be sent into stuttering. KC2WGB, KQLAW. Quick comment?
Okay. Pick up quick comment. Maybe Eric is still around and he could fill us in. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Okay, person with quick comment. Give us your call letters and name, sir. KQLAW.
Yeah, just for your info, this is Mike, K1MJM. That's K1 Mike Juliet Mike. You guys, I'm listening on both 375 and Echo Link, and they seem to be timed almost exactly the same. K1MJM, back to you, Dick.
Well, K1MJM, Michael, you're saying they're accurately timed. Run that by again. You are or not hearing a delay from one to the other, Mike? K1MJM, KQLAW.
Yes, this is K1MJM. Yes, I get interference from Torrington on 850 when I try to listen to you guys. So I've been going back and forth between 375 and Echo Link, and they are very, very, very close in timing compared to your 850, which has it's a couple of seconds faster than the 375 and Echo Link.
Interesting.
Okay, so there is a delay in that. And you and I thought, John, that when he established the RF link, that the delay would go away. And by some means, it has come back, maybe temporarily. KC2WGB, KQRIW.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, the other night it was in sync. It was perfect. And I've been monitoring it. Every once in a while, I notice it does this. And I forgot to mention it to Eric yesterday when I was speaking to him. So he probably knows about it, but I wasn't aware of it. I thought it was my imagination at first.
Maybe we shouldn't expect too much at once, John. We had some pretty yucky sound audio earlier, and that all got corrected we're going to count our blessings. I think the audio we're getting right now is a zillion dB better than what we had earlier. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, that setting he has right now, I agree. Get some super glue and glue those knobs right where they are. I know it's...